Nathan Fraser Show, episode number 99, Copywriters Against the PC Police, with Adil Amarcy.
Mixing business with politics. This is the Nathan Fraser Show.
All right, free market squad in the place to be. It's your boy, Nathan Fraser, High Priest of Propaganda. Thank you for taking a half hour out of your week to hang with me. And this week, we've got a very special guest, Adil Amarcy. We're going to jump into this. Before we do, you're a copywriter and you are in the UK, am I correct?
Yeah, I'm in London. And by the by, that surname, universally a rare name. So if anyone messes it up, I'm like, I'm not mad at you, because if you heard that, except unless you're Italian, you're saying it. You're probably not going to get it right first time.
Okay, nice. Well, I feel accomplished then. So you're in London, and London is like universally known as like the financial capital of the world, pretty much. So you're a copywriter in pretty much the capital of finance. How does that feel?
I really wish I knew more about that. It actually feels amazing, to be honest. I'm just kidding around. It's actually really cool living here. And it's interesting because when I moved to London, my income tripled the moment I moved to London. It was like the craziest thing.
All right. I'm going to have to move to London then.
Yeah. It's crazy because like there's that whole saying where if you move somewhere where everyone plays at a high level, you automatically like jump up a level.
Nice. So we've got, and just a warning to the listeners, you've got a lot of construction going on in the background, so that might creep into the interview, but that'll just add a little bit of spice to it. You do a podcast yourself. We kind of run in a lot of the same circles, and Shane Hunter, one of our mutual friends, told me to check you out, and so I've been listening to your podcast, and we've been talking back and forth, and I've wanted to get you on the show for a while, and it just fell into place today. So I'm super stoked to have you on. Before we get into it, though, I do want to give you a chance to kind of let people know what your podcast is all about and how you incorporate it into your business model.
Okay, cool. So first of all, guys, I apologize for said background noise. We're going to try and limit as much of that as possible. So, okay, my podcast is essentially It was birthed from this idea in 2013 that I got sick and tired of everyone doing the expert authority model. You know, like, hey guys, look at me, I'm amazing. I was like, yeah, I'm not that guy, because they seem so fake and one-sided. I know a lot of these guys, and there's a lot of their fun stuff that you don't get to see. So when I started doing this show particularly, Adil Amarcy Unplugged, it was this idea that I wanted to get guys on my show that could let loose, they would drop the guard and let their authentic self out. And this is before everyone started in the whole, I'm authentic, you need to be true to who you are. It was like way back before this shit became an actual marketing ploy. This is when I was like, you have customers, I want them to see the side of you that I see. I want to see the goofball that hangs out with me every weekend. I want to see the guy that like talks shit about the UFC. Sorry, excuse my language, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on the show. But there's that kind of thing. And it was like 100% just relaxed atmosphere is what I wanted. So when I started interviewing people, I just kept going without questions. And how that's affected my marketing is a lot of the people I actually end up interviewing end up hiring me, which is an amazing thing. But a lot of their listeners start hiring me as well, because they start coming up to me and start asking me, hey, can we be interviewed by you? But also, can you look at our consultations? Can you look at our structures? Can you look at our business models? Because again, what I do on my show is I don't hold back. So if someone has like an idea or a problem and they ask it on the show, I'll answer it right away. So it's quite an interesting thing. It's just a fun place, not so much be the authority, but just be the conduit of authorities to be showcased.
That's so weird, because I've heard of so many different, I guess, content marketing strategies that involve podcasting. But when I started watching what you were doing, it's kind of a new twist on it. I've seen people use the, like you said, I use the podcast to establish myself as an authority, so my listeners will come to me and hire me. But you have your guests coming to you and hiring you.
Yeah, it's kind of like a really weird twist, because the way I look at it is it's one of the I think I spoke to you about this a while ago. It's one of the strategies I was putting in my course on how to, like, if you had no list and no nothing, it would be basically start a podcast but be interesting about it. And then you'll see that your guests will start trying to hire you. Just simply because if you're interesting and people like what you do and you establish authority with your guest, not so much in the marketplace, but with the guest, they'll hire you and they'll end up spreading your message among their people.
So in your podcast, what are your typical guests? Who are the people that you're usually going after to interview?
It's kind of funny because I don't actually reach out to people to interview anymore. It's kind of got to the point where people like Courtney and Esther and a few other media companies, because they facilitate getting experts onto podcasts. They just have my email address. They'll send me like 4 or 5 guests a week and be like, hey, pick 2 or 3 of these or all 5 of them if you want. Let me know and we'll book them onto your show. And I'm like, yeah, cool. Get this person in. No, don't. It's turned, the entire model's been turned around from what it used to be, because the old model was the guests I'd look for were my friends on Facebook, would be people I found interesting and fun. So industry leaders like Ryan Levesque, like Shane Hunter, like yourself when you come on the show, like David Garfinkel, Matt Fury, all those guys, they're legends established in their own business and what they do, but I look up to them. It's usually people I want. This is a really long-winded way of saying, basically, it's people that I admire that I want to interview and speak to because I want to get to know more about them. But simultaneously, it's people that I know that I want the world to know more about. So, for instance, with like Ryan Levesque, when I had him on my show for the first time, I made him laugh absolutely crazy. Like he laughed half my podcast. And then the second time I had him around, I had him like laughing even more. And he was like, holy crap, dude, what are you doing? I was like, this is the craziest interview I've ever done. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, why? It's like, because it's just like all pretenses are dropped.
Well, and that is one of the things that I've noticed about your podcast is like you said, you just shoot from the hip. It's a very raw, conversational, and it's not the value model that you're not just focused on, let's just drop value bombs one after another, like some of the more prominent business podcasts out there.
Yeah, I mean, no offense to them, because what they do is absolutely amazing. And someone that will bring onto the spotlight is John Lee Dumas, who has Entrepreneur on Fire, right? And this is not a criticism to the guy. The guy's amazing at what he does. He brings great people on board, and they do give great knowledge. But you can hear after the first 2-3 seasons, his energy just dropped for me. Like I couldn't feel his energy as much anymore. So I didn't want to ever go into that angle because I get bored very easily. And again, Nathan, you know this because we've had this conversation with Shane, where I can't stick in one marketplace to write for too long because I get really, 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 really bored and I need to like challenge myself again. So I just said to myself, I need to shoot from the hip, which is where the title Unplugged came from, because it was a place for me to be me. Like, because you've heard me say it already in this show, guys, I swore by accident. Swearing is not like an intentional thing. It's just very secondary to me. And just comes out. So right now I'm doing my best to consciously not swear, but simultaneously on my show, you'll hear me swear. Like it's just because I wanted it to a place to be where someone could be free.
Yeah. And you don't have to worry about cussing on the show. We're not syndicated on the radio anymore. So swearing is okay. Just be yourself. I want to start off the interview with something that, cause I know you used to be a voice actor, correct?
Yeah, I did voice acting for a while.
Okay, so I want to ask you a question. A lot of American TV shows and American movies actually have British actors, and their ability to turn their British accent off and pick up an American accent is amazing to me. And then when I watch them in interviews, and it's totally back to the British accent, I guess from an American point of view, it has always baffled me how people can just turn the accent off and then turn it back on. What are your thoughts on that, coming from the fact that you actually have experience as a voice actor?
Oh, dude, I have the same situation. Like watching Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange knowing that he's got a really British voice, it's hilarious to me because it freaks me out. Like watching Doctor Strange, I'm like still expecting the British voice to come out. I'm like, it's not there. What's happening? It's the craziest thing. But from my perspective, I'm thankfully never really had to switch my accent all that much. In fact, because I have a very transatlantic accent, like to an American, I sound British. To a British person, I sound American. And it's all down to like certain habits I picked up when I was younger, which is like saying my R's very hard. So I have very hard R's when I speak. So it's really interesting. So I never really get asked to change my accent. In fact, I think two of the pieces that I did for voiceover work, which I can't mention because of publishing rights and stuff, one of the things they actually got, the character they had me play was from, dear Lord, where was he from? They basically wrote the characters in that he was from New York, but he lived in Montreal and spent a summer in England. That's why his accent's all messed up, because they're like, we can't use any other voice actor. He knows what he's doing. But simultaneously, we don't know where we can actually pinpoint him. So we'll just make something up in the backstory.
Nice. So we're going to talk about some uncomfortable stuff. Is that okay with you?
Oh, go for it, dude.
All right. I'm not going to get there yet, though, because I want to ease my way into it. So...
like a rubber glove.
Yeah, there you go. First, I want to talk about influences when it comes to copywriting. A lot of people, especially in my audience, are very anti-pop culture. And I get a lot of shit from people because I fully embrace pop culture, even though I see it as a total social engineering tool. I see pop culture as a lot of times... it's used as a tool to manipulate society as a whole. I also fully embrace a lot of aspects of pop culture because I like to know where my audience is at, because a lot of the average people don't see pop culture the same way that I do. I know that you're somebody who digs on pop culture in certain aspects. So when it comes to writing copy, what are some of your pop culture influences that help you, I guess, help you draw or derive inspiration for how you're going to write your sales copy?
Books are the big one for me. So, like, first of all, I'm going to go with, guys, I totally agree with you. Like, pop culture is an amazing social engineering tool. It's like one of the craziest things ever. And what you'll find is most copywriters are like Nathan and like you, in the sense of we generally don't like it. But if we're not using it to influence our audience, you're leaving money on the table and leaving something that's really powerful for your business on the table. That's the first thing I'd say. So my little preachy moment is over. To answer your question more directly, movies are a big one. So a lot of the stuff Marvel puts out, I do pay attention to, because what Marvel has learned how to do better than anyone else, specifically Disney has learned to do better than anyone else, is create their marketing in such a way that draws you in, if that makes sense. Like, I'll give you an example. I was watching Black Panther, and I'd seen one trailer for Black Panther, and I was like, I want to watch this. And this is from a guy that loves watching trailers, so I love watching movie trailers, see how they build up the tension, the hype, and what goes on. Nearly every single Disney-owned property, Marvel, LucasArts, anything like that, what you'll find is their trailers are probably done better than anyone else, because they give you just enough to get to whet your appetite, but not so much that you actually know what's going to happen. And they've blundered on this once or twice, but they've actually learned how to fix that mistake, which is brilliant. The other for me is comic books and general books and like fiction books, particularly crime novels. And I don't really follow the path of like read Stephen King all the time, because Stephen's a great writer. I won't ever deny that. I mean, the guy's he's a very prolific writer. It's crazy how much he puts out. But one of my favorite authors right now is a guy called Chris Carter, who writes in such a way that it enthralls me. I read through them, and if it holds my attention for a long period of time, like his first book, I read in 3 days, and I'm a slow reader. It took me 3 days to finish his book. I was like, holy crap, I devoured this thing. And the other thing, which I think you're really kind of, that I think would be the best thing for this interview, is something I recommend to everyone that learns copy from me. And that is to spend 6 hours on YouTube watching the Gears of War cutscenes for Gears of War 1, 2, and 3. And the reason I get people to do that is simply because the influences they pick up on are, how does this make me feel? Then I pause the damn thing. I write down a notepad. I feel sad equals character did X, Y, and Z, or felt X, Y, and Z. Music in background was this, score, and so on. So I really break it down. And then I reverse engineer that into my own business and my own marketing. Like, how can I get someone else to feel those same feelings?
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, emotional People buy based off of emotions, and if you can, and I hate to say if you can emotionally manipulate your audience, but a lot of it, that is what it is. And especially like when you see trailers, you were mentioning Disney's trailers. Disney's trailers are great at getting an emotional reaction from you in the minute and a half. They take you on an emotional roller coaster.
Oh yeah, they do. They're amazing at doing that. And if you want to make it sound pretty and what it is, I'd say you're emotionally persuading someone. And do you mind if I just quickly jump on the word persuasion for a second?
Absolutely.
All right. So I have this theory on there's three types of what we call persuasion, influence, and manipulation. There are actually three sides of the same coin. And you're like, Adel, but a coin only has two sides. No, it has three. I'll explain why. It's like, if you're a Star Wars fan, you'd understand this. Nathan, you're a Star Wars fan? I don't remember.
I'm a Star Wars fan up until I feel like they've ruined the franchise.
So the last six movies that they basically put out. Don't really blame you. I'm kidding. The original trilogy was amazing. So let's go on to like from that perspective. So you have the light side of the Jedi, which is the Jedi. You have the dark side, which is the Sith, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have Mace Windu, who is in the original, like Samuel Jackson basically played him. So I'll tell you why he embodies persuasion for me. You have the light side of the Jedi, which are, we're good and so on, we're doing everything for everyone else. They're basically what I would call influence. Then you have the Sith, who I would call the manipulators. These are the people that like prey on your fears. They push you in a certain way. They make you feel like shit and you keep going. I'd say most media outlets do this, personally, in my opinion, and a lot of the movements that are going on, but we won't, you know, we can touch on them in a minute. But the gray Jedi, which is Mace Windu, who fights for the good, but isn't afraid to dabble in the dark, meaning in the sense of he's mastered the dark side stuff to help his light side stuff. And that is the edge. So if you think of a coin, heads being light, tails being dark, and when you turn it to the side, that little bit around the side, that is the gray. That is where persuasion lives, because you need to be able to master the dark side of manipulation, which is the dark side of influence, but use the light side of influence to combine the two together to create a very powerful delivery mechanism to have people move forward towards a goal that serves them.
Mm. Wow. That's so deep. And I'm going to just talk about myself for a second. When I first got into marketing and this whole world, I had previously read Edward Bernays's book, Propaganda, and
Crystallizing Public Opinion, or his other book, Propaganda, because I knew he has two.
His first book, Propaganda.
Excellent.
But I came from it from the conspiracy theory point of view and was like, well, I can probably use some of this in my business. And so I started learning marketing from the point of view that this is all evil, but if it's going to help me get people to make a buying decision that helps both of us, then I might as well know which tools out there exist. And that's what you said right there about knowing both sides and walking that thin line in between, as long as it's to the advantage of your customer. That's so reminiscent of my approach, but it's also something that I'm not in most circles, I'm not comfortable saying out loud, because a lot of people just won't understand that.
Yeah, no, they really won't, which is why I came up with this whole idea of the gray line.
Nice. So,
because the only way I could do it.
So you mentioned, well, there's a couple different ways that we can go. I want to talk about, let's just kind of divert down the path. You said something about movements and emotional manipulation being used in movements. What are you hinting at when you say that?
Well, look at the Me Too campaign. That's emotional manipulation if I've ever seen it.
How so? And well, feel free to let it all out, because I won't censor you on this.
Okay, cool. So I have this whole thing, and this is something I'm becoming more and more comfortable with, is expressing my opinion. But the Me Too campaign was, if you actually listen to the founder of the Me Too campaign, when men started to come out and actually say that, oh, hey, I've been a victim of this too from women, from other men, she flipped a gasket, just like blew her gasket, went straight out and said it was only for women to actually say this. You're still trying to take over what we do as women. So it was almost like a dividing line. Mm. And you can see the emotional manipulation being played here, because it's kind of take it from an emotional standpoint. You should allow your shame and guilt to be let go of and bring the abusers to light is the message. But the moment you do that and you're not the target audience, you are shunned, you are made to feel guilty and shamed, which is emotionally manipulative, which makes it much worse for the person that was doing it to open up again. It's almost silencing. It's silencing because of your gender of being male.
Hmm.
So under that, guys, that's just one example. You can find any movement online. And by the way, I don't just mean with this. I mean, there's people that are, and again, I support Black Lives Matter, and I get that. I believe all lives matter. But at the same time, you'll find emotional manipulation in that as well. And I don't just mean from the people that are actually saying, hey, Black Lives Matter. I'm talking about the people that are going against it, saying, why are you saying only Black Lives Matter? I'm like, dude, let's be honest here. White privilege is a thing. I'm a brown dude. I've actually experienced both sides of the coin. I know what it's like to hang out with people who are all white and they're cool and I get along with them. But I've also been around people that I grew up with in the hood. We've experienced the same shit. We've gone through that same stuff. It's more classism than it is racism, if we're really being honest. But that's a whole different subject in its own right. But if you look at the manipulations they're actually using in that movement, it's kind of saying because you're taking stance you're speaking up against a certain prejudice, that's a global prejudice, really. What we're actually going to do now is we're going to belittle it by actually adding our own, not controversial, but like we're going to add our own contrarian taken to this, and because of that, what's now happening is the emotional manipulation gets played into the fact that your point is invalid, so it's manipulating that point and actually turning it from an emotional standpoint to get the other person angry. So it just makes them say, hey, you see, they can't even have a conversation without being angry.
So let's have a conversation without getting angry, because I'm gonna flip this around. So I am white, well, mostly white. I grew up in a Mexican household, and my grandpa is Native American, and so I come from like a very varied multicultural background. But if you just look at me, I'm a very light skinned guy, so I pass as white. But I grew up in the hood, so like you said, the whole classism versus racism. When I was growing up, I grew up with predominantly Black and Mexican kids, so I didn't really understand the whole racist mentality, because it seemed like we were all the same. We were all treated the same. I didn't ever feel like I had an advantage or a one-up on my friends just because of my skin color. In fact, a lot of times I felt like I had it worse off because I was the minority in a lot of situations. But so I also get like, I also get the Black Lives Matter. I see it from both sides. Police brutality is out of control, especially in this country. And Black people are often the targets of that, whether it's because of the environment that they are in, or whether because it's just racist cops. It's up for debate, and I don't think it's a single-sided issue. Back to the emotional manipulation, and we're going to tie this into comic books, because I'm a huge comic book nerd.
Awesome.
I love comic books. We've seen in comic books, we've seen like this push for diversity, and we've seen you have to have more Black characters, and we need to get rid of white characters. And so from that point of view, there's kind of two ways to look at it. White people, and I'm not one of these, like I'm kind of against identitarian politics as a whole. So I'm not like I don't like white nationalism, and I don't like the white genocide people that are like, we got to stick up for the white culture. Cause I'm not a big fan of.
Yeah, no, I get that.
But I do have to say this though, cause you were talking about the Me Too movement, and you were talking about how they use their victim status as a tool to gain power. And when other people said, well, we've experienced the same thing, they said, well, no, we're in power from this movement, and we're not allowing this movement to empower you. I have seen something that's disturbed me in comic books where minority status has been used as a weapon, and has been used as a defense mechanism, where you put a Black author on a book, and we'll say Ta-Nehisi Coates, because he's been writing Black Panther. Ta-Nehisi Coates cannot write a good comic book to save his life, but he's Black, so he's got the privilege of not being able to lose his job because they're afraid that they'll look racist if they fire him. He's ran the Black Panther comic book series into the ground multiple times. Sales are like the worst that it's ever been. And when the fans don't buy it, they get accused of being called, or they get called racist.
But which is stupid.
And those same fans go out and make a really well-written Black Panther movie, the most, like, a record-breaking box office success. Those same fans that are being called racist for not buying the comic are showing up in droves to watch the movie. So I guess my question is, what are your thoughts on when people take a victim status and use it as a shield to deflect actual legitimate criticism? So you don't like my work, therefore you're sexist. You don't like my work, therefore you're racist. And how the power dynamic is sort of shifting, where if you're a woman, you're allowed to talk about these things. If you're a person of color, quote unquote, you're allowed to talk about these things. But if you're a cis white male, you're not allowed to say certain things.
See, even that term cis white male pisses me off. That stuff really pisses me off. Because I'm like, seriously, dude, what the actual fuck are you talking about right now? You're male and you're gender. You're male and you're white. There we go. I'm a brown male. That's basically all it should be. It's like, how do you identify yourself as, like, by all means, have freedom of speech. And I'm totally down for that. I will die on the day that someone tries to take my free speech away. I would rather die than actually have that happen, just simply because the same with anyone. Anyone can have a conversation about the stuff as long as you're not getting emotionally angry about it and actually just like trying to talk down the other side. That's stupid. So let's deconstruct what you've essentially given me. Number one, if you're a shit writer, fuck you. I don't care what your skin tone is, what your gender is, whatever it is, the fuck out of here. You suck. You should be hired on your merit, not on your skin tone. Two, I agree with you. I'm really disappointed with the fact they're trying to get, oh, we need to increase more black characters, but we need to eliminate more white characters from comic books, TV shows, and so on. I'm like, no. There is nowhere that says you can't have the same, you can't add more characters. You can't, guys, we've created three new Mexican characters, two black characters, two brown characters, and one white character. I'm like, cool, enjoy, there's your new team, or even two white characters. Two of each. Do a Noah's Ark on it. Don't really give a shit. It's completely fine and well. The intention is, how does that story cohesively play out and what you're trying to get to? I mean, if you look at a show like Black Lightning, which is by DC Comics, the first episode, I fucking loved it. I was like, holy shit, they've got a black character based on a comic book they had written years ago that wasn't a bestseller, but they've adapted it really well. It's actually more or less around the Ferguson issue and how Black Lives Matter, and they're basically being a little political with it, but at the same time, they're trying to show unity in the sense of, guys, we got to stop killing each other and put out a positive message amongst the neighborhoods to say, hey, we need to create safe havens because the only way we can get ourselves out is by empowering through positivity and not taking the victim stance. And then the next episode, they're like, yeah, his daughter's a lesbian. I was like, you've essentially, you're cramming too many things into one bandwagon. Seriously, start going, create separate aspects for each one of these things. And what's happened with Black Panther right now being a huge box office success that it is, that will start to happen. People won't be bandwagoning and trying to push everything into one thing at the same time. Because one of the weirdest criticisms I heard about Black Panther was, why were there no lesbian characters in Black Panther? To which my response was, shut the fuck up, you asshole. Don't really care.
Well, and I think that's the thing is, like, and as a writer, you probably know this. You don't need to put things into the plot if they don't drive the plot. If it doesn't drive the sale, it doesn't belong in the sales letter. So if it's not relevant to the plot, then, you know, why would you have lesbian characters just to say you had lesbian characters? If it doesn't help, if it's not necessary to the plot, then a good writer knows that you're supposed to be writing a story that's captivating, not a story that's helping you check off a bunch of boxes off of a list.
Yeah, a political checklist, as I would call it. Like, I'll give you a case example. It's perfect with this. Taika Waititi, who is an amazingly funny... He's a funny fucking writer. I mean, you've seen Thor Ragnarok, right?
Yeah.
I love that movie. Taika's hilarious. But one of the scenes they cut from that movie was Valkyrie... Like, in the morning, Valkyrie's lover, she was a woman, literally walks out because Valkyrie is bisexual. She walks out of her ship and goes home. And when he was asked, why did you cut that out? His response was... I had to get it under a certain runtime. We were already over 2 hours at this point. I was like, I was trimming off scenes. I mean, I took off a scene where Thor was making a funny joke or something. He goes, I cut everywhere I could that wasn't relevant to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, okay. It was like, look, if you really want to see what her sexuality is, look at the flashback scene. That tells you everything. It's like, why am I beating this over the head? I don't need to. You trim the fat and you keep it going. Now, what was there was a question you actually asked me as well. I was so focused on the first bit that I forgot the second bit. Could you just repeat the second bit for me? It was the influence of how these movements move forward, wasn't it?
I'm trying
to remember what it was.
I think maybe I don't even know. We've kind of gone down a rabbit trail here, but
it's all good.
I guess maybe the reversal of power, where I guess to get your thoughts on this, like now the privilege roles have been reversed, where like it seems like in a lot of areas, like you were talking about the Me Too movement, women actually have power over men now. In Ta-Nehisi Coates' instance, where if a white person is writing consistently crappy comic books, they can absolutely be fired. Yeah. So I guess
it's basically a hijack of power, in my opinion. That's kind of stupid because again, it's the same thing that they're trying to dress it up as a new. We're going for a revolution. I'm like, no. All you're doing is you're just shifting the board around. The chess pieces are all in the same place. You're just turning the board around. That's all you've done. You're never, if all you're screaming for is equality, but you're still keeping the same submersive and the submersive pieces in place and all the places of power as they are, you're not really changing anything. That's a case in point here, and people in America may hate me for this, but I don't really care. I study everything that I see, and again, like you, I come from a conspiracy standpoint. Look at what Bush did, and look at what Obama did. And a lot of people, before Obama came to office, Bush was like, the country was ready at riot revolution. They were like, we're going to do a revolution. We're going to take our country back. Obama gets in power. Revolution dies almost instantly. Like overnight just dies. No one's talking about it that much anymore. It's all quieting down. Look at the atrocities that Obama committed in office. But he gets a pass because he's a black guy. Bush does the exact same atrocities as does, say, Trump. But they're under the scope because they're white. That makes sense?
Yeah.
And because of that, it's a reversal of power that isn't moving equality forward. In fact, it's subjugation of another people. I mean, it's kind of like the best way I can put this. Imagine for a moment that someone was enslaved on a farm. They don't like let's just say it was a beige human being. Actually, let's make it even different. Let's go. It's an actual alien from another planet, a Martian. You enslaved a Martian on Earth to be your servant and to serve you as they would. They are basically beneath you and they're subhuman at this point, that you don't even class them as a person. They rise up and they take over your house. But when they're rising up to rally the other enslaved Martians, they say, we want equality. We want the same lives that those people live. But instead of actually rising up and then kind of having equal rights to say, hey, guys, I know you guys were assholes about this, but you know what? We've forgiven it. Let's move on. Let's build a better world today. Essentially, what you're doing is like, now you're my bitch. Now you're going to be the ones enslaved. So do you see the power dynamic doesn't really – it shifts and changes, but the actual rules of the game haven't changed at all. In fact, you're just, again, moving chess pieces around and you're still going to get the same result, because I guarantee you in about 30 years' time, or even in 10 years, if not quicker, because of how quickly social media changes everything, you're going to see that shift is going to happen, and then another shift is going to happen where the people are in power today, or the ones that are coming into power today, will be usurped by another people.
Wow.
And that will continue a cycle down the path until we will basically break up into tribes. And anyone that says this is a race thing, I guarantee you, look at anywhere in the world where the people are of the same race, and I guarantee you they will fight each other to the death. It's tribal, it's political, and it's actually figuring out what you like and what you don't like and what your belief structure is. That's all it is. And it's given, as I mentioned, it's given this whole thing of racism, which is the lowest form. But if you really look at it, what it is, it's classism. It's the class of where you come from. And if you look at the classism problem, I guarantee you from that perspective, you'll find high levels of freedom. And how this all relates down to writing, for the people who are wondering, how does this all work out into copywriting and money, Adil? Well, quite simply, if you can write, if you can look at the polarizing aspects of society, then you can speak to either one and find the middle ground to walk through and create the persuasion that's needed to bring peace and unity through your service and actions. Because if you have those, you know who you're serving.
So I'm going to take it I'm going to kind of tilt on this and take it a slightly different direction and ask your opinion. We see this situation where here in America, if you watch Fox News, the message that you get is your morals are superior. You're so smart. Look at those stupid idiots over there. In fact, look at the craziest person out of those idiots. That person represents all those idiots. They're evil. They're trying to destroy America. You're the good guy. They're the bad guy. Let's all rally together and get this done. But then when you watch CNN, it's the exact same message, but reversed. It's you, the CNN viewer, you're so smart, you're so educated, you're so elite, you are trying to save the country. See that crazy redneck idiot racist over there? He represents everybody that watches Fox News. They're all evil. They're all trying to destroy the country. We have to unite to stop their evil plans because they're going to destroy the country. You mentioned tribalism, and it seems like when it comes to political movements, marketing and tribalism and knowing how to divide and pick an enemy to throw stones at is so important on making this work. How does that apply to is there a hint of marketing there?
Entirely. Dude, it's basic 101. It's the you can get this in dating, marketing, business, everywhere. And I'll tell you, it's called the straw man technique. The straw man technique is basically creating an enemy based on one person's belief and structures and stuff like that, and forcing the person that you're speaking to for them to actually turn against the straw man. So in dating is the best way I can put this. So don't do this is my disclaimer, because the karmic side of it will bite you in the ass. It was a technique that a friend of mine told me about years and years ago. It's actually incredible when you look at it from a psychological standpoint, which we're going to do. And the technique is quite simple. Nathan, I'm going to get you role play with me here for a second. Is that okay, buddy?
Yeah.
Cool. So if I walked up to Nathan and let's just say he was let's say Nathan and I are both out on the same night, and Nathan's girlfriend, hypothetical girlfriend in this case, because I don't know if you're married or whatever, but like his partner in this case, whoever it is, I find them attractive and Nathan's not in the room. Me and Nathan don't know each other. And the first thing I do is I walk up to the girl and I start saying stuff like, hey, you know, whatever conversation. She goes, oh, I have a boyfriend. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. So tell me, does your boyfriend take you out to this place? I'm using a very basic version here. Does your boyfriend take you out to this restaurant? Because that's where I take all my first dates. And it's a restaurant I know she wants to go to. It's like, no. Essentially what I'm doing is I'm taking what is Nathan's real character, picking out the pieces that I want her to see, and forming them into a straw man, into an effigy. Because what she's going to do is everything I'm saying that I am, i.e. you're so smart, you're so brilliant, I'm so smart, I'm so brilliant. In fact, we have the same values and stuff. Nathan doesn't have those. And she's like, she starts questioning. People start questioning why they're following a certain allegiance, or why they're, it's, you're throwing rocks at an enemy that isn't there. You're basically creating an enemy to throw against, i.e. the straw man. And in the end, that person, Nathan's girlfriend in this case, would turn and burn Nathan alive and leave with me. Now, how that works on a marketing standpoint and in everything else is exactly it. Fox News and CNN and all these other places will throw rocks at the enemies and allay your fears while simultaneously confirming your suspicions. I think it was it Blair Warren that had the one sentence persuasion? Mm-hmm. If you really deconstruct that, which I think I've said 3 of the 7 right there, what he teaches is exactly what happens in everyday news broadcasts, in newspapers, in Facebook posts, in political movements, in social movements. Try and find a place. And something I will say I'm guilty of, because Nathan, I'll give you guys listening to this that don't know me, Shane Hunter, who is, again, a mutual friend of ours, has turned around and yelled at me at this. He goes, I don't understand why you don't do what you do on a higher level. Nathan's seen me do this, and he's even questioned me and said, why don't you do more with what you do? And the reason I'll reveal right now, which I don't really like to talk about, but I will hear for you guys, the reason is I'm trying to find a way to not walk that line of being polarizing and make an enemy out of something or someone and still see if you can succeed. And I'll tell you right now, it's so much harder to do. So the easy path is that you can find a fictional enemy in the sense of like laziness, procrastination, or as I like to call it, procrastination. Because let's be honest, most of the time you're procrastinating, you're masturbating. It's what you do, procrastination. You have your own thing against it. So you can turn that into an enemy. In my mind, it has to be a person rather than an ideal. But you can do that with anything. Essentially, it's study Blair Warren's one-sentence persuasion, and I guarantee you'll see through all the stuff that the news is throwing at you, and you'll be able to make up your own decision in mind from that. And something I will say right now that very few people know, I mean, Nathan, you've seen it. Everyone that sees my post, they think I'm a liberal, which is lovely. But the truth is, I'm actually a conservative with very liberal views. I walk the line of I call them a centrist because I don't know what else they're called. But at least that's my vocabulary for it. Meaning I walk the middle line. The shit I agree with that's on the liberal side and the shit that I think they're ridiculous at. Same with the conservatives. I mean, I look at it and go, I see where you're coming from, but you're being a completely idiotic person here.
Yeah.
Yay.
I feel like I'm kind of the same way. I feel like on certain things, I kind of tend to... Depending on what the situation is, I tend to fall on the side of individual liberty, and sometimes the liberals are for individual liberty on certain issues, and they're for absolute authoritarianism on other issues. And so,
agreed.
On the ones that they fall for liberty, I'm with them on that. And when the ones where they're being authoritarian cunts, I'm like, nah, can't follow you on that. I want to ask, and this is going to be like a culture type thing, because I follow a lot of, you brought up the word centrist, and I follow a lot of YouTubers that that are from Australia and from the UK, and a lot of them that claim that term centrist. And one of the big things that's going on in the movement of people who call themselves centrists is censorship that is going on right now in Europe and in that whole area. Cause you guys don't have like, and we really almost don't anymore either. The whole First Amendment, you guys really don't have anything that protects free speech the way that we do over here. And you mentioned earlier about how important free speech was to you. What are your thoughts on some of the like hate speech laws and some of the stuff that's going on over there right now when it comes to YouTube videos being demonetized for talking about things that the politicians don't want people talking about, people being arrested for jokes that they make online or things that they say? Like, there's been multiple instances of people getting into legal situations for social media posts that didn't hurt anybody. What are your thoughts on that? And then I'm going to tie it into marketing, and then I'll try to stop talking your ear off.
It's all good. I love this. It's brilliant. But what I was going to say was, so I have a slightly unique view on this, and I say slightly unique because a lot of the stuff that gets said about actually affects me directly. Because a lot of it is very anti-Muslim or whatever it is. It's like anti-immigration, anti-Muslim, all the other fun stuff. And I only say that because I'm only focusing on the negative side, because that's the stuff that gets censored right now. Anything that's talking about the pro whatever it is rarely gets censored, which is stupid on both sides. Because the way I look at it is that you have to walk, again, it's walking that gray line. It's how much can you say in one way, because I do believe free speech is there. What I don't believe in is hate speech. I want to clarify what I mean by this. If you're going out saying all people of said race, religion, color, whatever it is in creed, they deserve to die, I'm like, okay, that should be demonetized. That's not free speech. That's hate speech. You're inciting hate. But if all you're saying is bring up a valid fucking point, like in the sense of, okay, guys, our police force is being put into watch in these neighborhoods. Those aren't the most violent neighborhoods that we need to put on watch. In fact, it's these neighborhoods. It doesn't matter if the highest population is Jewish, Muslim, Christian, black, white, Hispanic, brown, whatever you want to go with. It doesn't, or even Chinese or Japanese. It doesn't really matter what neighborhood it is. You're actually talking about the issue and not the people. then I'm on board with it. It's when you start talking about individual groups and start rallying behind one single group, you start to add oil into the water, so to say. Like, you go from a very crystal clear message to one that can be seems quite murky, and you have an unintentional result. Now, the fact they're being banned, the fact that they're being taken down, arrested, social media posts are causing people to lose their jobs. I'm like, at that moment, that's kind of stupid. I don't agree with that. It's only the only time I agree with it if it's true hate speech. Like, and the way you have a very strong barometer in our generation, really. And that is, everyone equates it back to the Nazis. And that is in the sense of, does this fall on par with Nazism and nationalism? If it does, and it's actually calling for rounding up a certain people, rounding up and killing of people, if it's calling for that kind of thing, by all means, ban it. But if all it's doing is actually saying, look, guys, we're letting in refugees into our borders, into an overburdened system that we cannot, even right now, cannot support. So we're just letting more people in. This is going to hurt us down the line. That shouldn't be banned. That should actually be looked at and gone, what are the people saying? Why are they saying this? Okay, how can we see the bigger picture and find a way to actually make this all work? Not be demonized in one way or another and banned by other people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm one of those people. I have a lot of friends that are very conservative and right leaning, and they're anti-immigration. And I personally, I feel the plight of people that are, you know, if I was living in a place where it was extreme poverty, if I was living in a place where there were
bombs all the time, yeah, being dropped exactly, on you, stuff like that.
Exactly. I feel, as a human being born on this planet, I feel like, as an autonomous person, I should have the right. If I'm not moving just to mooch off of some welfare, or if I'm not moving to plot an attack and get revenge, if I'm just wanting to save my children from the hellhole that I don't want them to grow up in, I don't see why I shouldn't be able to move. So I feel like I have to grant that to other people too. So I'm not a big fan of the close all the borders, but I'm also not a big fan of saying, hey, we're not even allowed to talk about this, because when you're not allowed to talk about things, it causes the situation to get worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree. That is basically all it is. It's that exact same sentiment. Look, you should be autonomous. People that have, because I'm saying this from a person that's right now going through like his own issue, and I'll explain that after the show to you. As someone that's seen that, I can guarantee you right now, I'm not a fan of people having their autonomy taken away from them. But also, I'm not a fan of, let's just open up the fucking borders and let every single person in. You need to, yes, you need a vetting system, but to believe that the vetting system isn't already tough as it is a lie. Try going to another country that has as strict border control as anywhere in the Western world. I guarantee you'll make you wonder why people even try to get here, and then you'll realize their desperation. So under that same reasoning, I say have slightly looser vetting. Don't try and say the vetting restrictions aren't hard enough, as they are. They're fucking damn near impossible. What I'm getting at is, you should have full autonomy to travel wherever the hell you want, by all means. But if you have to be vetted to a certain degree, at least a criminal background check. See if any agencies or intelligence agencies have you on a list for some reason. If they have that under a person of suspicion and you check out as a person of suspicion, then by all means, at that moment, yeah, they can deny you entry. That's fine. It's not like when they're like, oh, you must be from this country, so we're automatically going to say that you can't come in. That's just stupid.
Yeah, well, and that goes back to the
tribalism.
Yeah, and picking a straw and making a straw man and painting everybody as that. That was really not where I was actually going with my question, though.
Fair enough.
What I was going to ask, though, is you're an advertiser and you live in Europe. And right now there's a thing where just last year, the end of last year, the advertising standards authority of Britain started cracking down on gender stereotypes in ads. So you're not allowed to, legally, you're not allowed to make ads that are gender specific. And it, I don't know how it fully implemented it's been, but it's being used to go after Beachbody ready ads. It's being used to go after toys, advertising for toys. So when it comes to somebody who is pro free speech and also an advertiser, what are your thoughts on when regulators come in and start pushing censorship, in my opinion, in some ways that don't need to be there? We don't have to deal with that here, but I am worried that it's going to creep its way over here.
I'm not a huge fan of that at all, because I'm like, look, dude, it's, I dislike it personally, in my opinion, because what you're doing is now you're censoring out a niche market. I mean, what if that person really does want to have a beach body ready? They want to be beach. They want to have a beach body. They want to get ready. How else are they going to know about it? Are they supposed to go, oh, I can't talk about losing all this weight that I want to lose, just because that person over there feels like they're too fat, or they feel like they're being shamed for something? No, I'm being targeted because it's a personal ad to me. If you go back to the response thing, it's, I get gender specificness to a certain degree, but again, it's censorship and I don't like it, because essentially what you're doing is you're taking away my right of saying, hey, I want to be spoken to. Because now you're making the message very ambiguous rather than specific. So it takes away all personality and all personalization to me.
Yeah. And as an advertiser, one of the first things that we do is when we're working for a client, we say, well, who's the avatar? Is it a male in his 50s? Is it a female in her 20s? And if we're not allowed to talk to that demographic based off of those specifics, it seems like they're trying to put handcuffs on us or tie our shoes together and still expect us to run the marathon.
Yeah, it's damn near impossible, because these standards, people say advertising standards are being raised. They're actually going the opposite way right now, where they're being lowered to a point where, it, again, like you said, you're being tied up and being told to run a marathon. It's nearly impossible to do. But I'd even say, as far as you're saying, you're just basically being told you have to hop an entire marathon, because you have some movement, but it's pretty damn hard.
Nice.
So I disagree with it.
Okay, cool. All right, man. This has been a very, I didn't think it was too uncomfortable, but we've talked about some stuff that I appreciate you indulging me in this conversation, because a lot of people would not have this conversation with me.
Oh, dude, I'm so glad I managed to do that. I mean, granted, guys listening to this, I'm sorry that like we didn't actually cover all the, you know, there was stuff I'm sure Nathan and I will speak about in future on another episode, but it's one of those things. We took some turns, but I hope you guys got a lot out of this, particularly as well, because a lot of the stuff that we said of polarization, you can use that in your marketing anytime you want.
Nice. All right. So before we're out of there, or before we're out of here, I definitely want to let people know about your podcast and where they can find out more about you and where they can go if they want to, if they want to hire you for consulting or hire you to write their sales copy.
Okay, cool. So guys, go check out adilamarsi.com. That's my main site. So it's adilamarsi.com. Click on the podcast link that's there to actually listen to the show, or on iTunes on Adil Amarsi Unplugged. If you want to work with me or hire me for anything, or just, you know, get a consultation with me, go to the same site /consulting, or just click the consultation tab and you'll be able to fill out a form, send it over to me. Just follow the rules that are on there. Send me an email. And of course, you know, we'll get back in touch and jump on a call and see how we can work together moving forward. But thanks again for having me, Nathan. I really appreciate it.
Oh, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I had a blast during this talk. I know my listeners are going to get a lot out of this, because like your podcast, mine's not always just value, 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 marketing, marketing, marketing. I like to have these conversations where we kind of we take deep dives into other aspects of society and how they apply to our marketing. So I had a blast. I, again, thank you for coming on. And listeners out there, Free Market Squad, definitely go check out Adil's website, adilamarsi.com. And check out his podcast, because I subscribed to it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm thoroughly enjoying all the people that you bring on.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. And guys, Nathan, thank you again for having me. I really, really enjoyed myself.
All right. All right, Free Market Squad, we are out of here. Until next time, faith in each other, not in authority. Be your own boss. Hashtag BYO boss. We will catch you later. Deuces.
Take care, guys.
Okay, episode 100 is right around the corner. I've got some exciting news about the future of the Free Market Squad. Don't miss it. I'm out of here. Deuces.